Good evening, everybody. Thanks for being here. Good to see you all. As we've been doing the last several weeks, we're going to start with the homework. At the end of every talk, I'm giving you all something to think about for the week, and then at the beginning of every talk, seeing what happens. So what I had suggested last week is that you pay attention to two points that came up toward the end of the last couple of chapters that we did. The question of speech, how we speak and how our speaking influences us, and generosity, the feeling of expansiveness or the feeling of contraction. And so I was saying, you know, notice those two things just as you go through the course of your everyday life. Your speaking, your feeling, and see what you learn from that. So, if there are any comments about that, anything that you've found out about it that you'd like to share, raise your hand. And I guess Shufi is our host. Is that right, Shufi? Yeah, she's the host. So she can call on you when she sees your electronic hand.
I see Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Yes, hi. I found it very interesting that the ideation before I speak isn't always generous, but that I have a chance to make it generous. But my thought, and I think this is against the precepts even, that it's not always generous. So.
Yeah, well, that is interesting, but I mean, it's a good thing, though, that between the thought and the word, there's some practice there that changes it.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like you're saying you sort of have to force yourself or censor yourself. It sounds like it's fairly normal and easy for you to do. So that is kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
A well-trained monk, like they say. You know? Thank you.
John.
Well, as always, it seems to be more apparent to notice things when you're falling out of practice. In other words, you know, one of those situations again recently with, you know, some support I needed, you know, phone support on something that wasn't working and, you know, getting very frustrated with them not addressing the issue and all that sort of stuff. And you just realize, you know, you're getting your hackles up, you start speaking differently in a different tone, and you certainly don't have the feelings of much generosity toward that person. And in the process of feeling that, yes, I tend to catch this sort of in process or after I've maybe said something a little snarky, and then, you know, try to reverse myself as soon as possible. Say, look, I'm sorry, I'm just had a bad day, or, you know, or this, you know, I don't mean to write it to be snarky or difficult with you, but it's very evident when you fall out of practice, I feel, that you can see this lack of generosity in you because you can hear it yourself. On the other hand, you know, when I am generous, well, excuse me, when I am using kind speech and sensitive speech, you know, everything feels right and you want to do more for them. You want to help more. You want to be complimentary. You want to be open and accepting. But that's just not the way it is all the time. So practicing by maybe slip-ups is just part of practice.
Yeah, and you notice when you start getting snarky, it doesn't make you that happy. You know, you feel
grumpy.
You're grumpy to begin with. You speak grumpy, then you get more grumpy, and it's not a pleasant thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and those calls shouldn't be done when you're tired or frustrated.
Yeah, right.
So, anyway, thank you.
Yeah.
Paula.
Yeah. Hi, everyone.
Similarly, I had a situation where I sent one of my good friends and her husband an invitation to come over to our house. And neither of them replied. And I got very snarky about it. I was complaining to my husband, like, they don't even care to give us a response. And then I remember the homework. And it was very helpful because I kind of immediately were able to stop talking like that. It made me feel really bad to speak about them in that way. And I tried to enter that generous space and I sent her a message again and I said, I hope you're doing okay. And this time she answered and she said she's been having a very rough time. So I'm glad that I did that and didn't stay mad or offended. So
Yeah, stuff like that is very astonishing because you realize that you're seeing everything from your own point of view, right? It's like they don't exist. The only thing that exists is what they did to me or did or failed to do to me, you know. And you realize, wow, that is really crazy, you know. It's really crazy because obviously the other people have lives, they have stuff is going on and all that. But it's totally normal to be that way, right? Totally normal. All the you think of all the hurts and slights that are going on all the time that have no business being there at all because they don't even exist, you know. Yeah, it's amazing. It's human relations are staggeringly stupid and amazing, really. I'm very impressed with the whole thing. But it's great that that'll probably always occur to you know, from now on when the next time you feel like somebody did you a wrong turn, you might think twice and think, well, you know, maybe something bad is happening to them. Maybe they didn't, or whatever, they didn't get the email or something, you know. One or two more.
Sue.
I just want to raise a question that popped into my mind, which is, what is our obligation in view of the precepts to use kind speech when we're talking to some AI voice on the phone that is driving us up the wall? And I'm saying, you know, I just can't understand the technology of this. It's too complicated. What can't you explain it to me more simply or something? And then this voice says, oh, my mother got a computer when she was really old too, and she really worked at it, and she got the better of it. Or this was a conversation I had recently with some AI voice. Anyway, but sometimes I think, oh well, the good thing about it is that I can just really go ahead and yell at them, and I'm not going to hurt anybody's feelings. I'm bringing that up as a possible. Something we'll maybe have to deal with more and more and think about right speech with AI.
Well, I think we're in very, very new territory here. I don't think the Buddha had he would be astonished to hear about this. But I do notice that when I say thank you to Siri, Siri says, "Oh, you're welcome."
Yeah. Well,
And
she's very
so
bad.
that's nice, you know. So that's nice. So you could be polite to the AI, and they'll be polite back, right? I don't know. It's a, you know, you should try it out and see. Try to be nasty, really nasty to the AI, and see if they're
I
nasty
haven't
back.
really let everything
I don't
fly.
think. Yeah, I don't think they're nasty back. I think it's bad for business to be nasty back. So they're always very agreeable, I think, to AIs. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, well, all right. So let's go on to the next. Oh, one more. I see one more.
Just a quick observation on that subject. I was thinking before Sue spoke, what you said about human relationships are so complicated, and I think it's much harder now because you have so many more relationships and ways of communicating because of technology. Like I'm constantly feeling like I'm being rude to people by not answering their text immediately, or I don't get to their email, or you know, people are saying stuff to me on social media and I'm not getting back. So I honestly think it's more of a strain now, you know, to really follow the precepts with that much precision.
Yeah, no, you're right. I have that too, you know, how all the people that I'm not answering that I forgot that I meant to and all that, you know. And if I say something publicly on social media or something like that, I sometimes get huge amounts of people mad at me and so on. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. My solution to it, the best that I can do, is just to feel like I really don't want to be callous or uncaring, and I really am doing my best. And so I have to just trust that. Because I mean, the other thing is that I also have to sort of like eat meals and do the dishes and sleep and get exercise and watch football games and stuff like that. You know, I have to do those things. So that takes time. So I guess if I stop doing all those things, I could answer everything and be much more courteous, but I can't do that. So I just figure, well, I just check my motivation and check my, my thoughts, and then do my best, and then I just have to live with the results. You know, if it has happened more than once, I'm sorry to say that people got really mad at me and said, you know, okay, that's all for you, I'm out of here, and stuff like that. That happens, and I didn't want that to happen, and I was sorry about it, but I couldn't prevent it. So what can you do? But it is complicated. Yes, we have a very crowded world with a lot of human beings in it, and they're all doing a bunch of stuff more than they ever did because they have more ways of doing it, and it's very complicated. So, but I think we can live simply and happily anyway. But yeah, you're right. It is complicated. Yeah. The Buddha had it easy, right? He didn't have these
Yeah, how many
complications,
people
right?
did the Buddha know?
Yeah, he just went around, you know, wandering from place to place. And while he was on the road, nobody called him up. Nobody bothered him. You know, he just was walking along. And then when he got to the place, people came to see him, and he saw that when they talked to him, he could see them, and he could hear them, and he could respond to them. Yeah, so he didn't have it nearly as hard as we do. Yeah, true.
Thank
So, okay, let's go on. Let's go on. This is an endless conversation, but we'll have it little by little as we go on here. So we're on chapter 14. Tonight we're going to do 14 and 15. And chapter 14 is called The Buddha. And the Buddha, I have a ringing noise coming from my little recorder here. I don't know why. So I will have to turn it off. Chapter 14 is called The Buddha. And the Buddha is our exemplar. The Buddha is our example. The Buddha is what we are all aspiring to. We would all aspire to be awakened from our dream of confusion and attachment. We would all aspire to be able to live happily and kindly, to be in accord with the way life really goes, and to be in accord with everyone around us. This is what we would like, right? And it seems that human beings have always had, at least as far as recorded time, recorded human history goes, human beings have always had some kind of imagined ideal. However impossible it may be to realize, we've always projected some ideal because we need a direction to go in. We need an endless project to spur us on and illuminate us. And I think it's this that brings us the deepest kind of human satisfaction. So that's the Buddha. On the one hand, we say, there's the Buddha way off there in the distance. We can see the Buddha. We can be inspired by the Buddha. The Buddha is drawing us on with his teaching, and we're trying our best, but boy, is it a long way away. And boy, do we have a long way to go. On the one hand. On the other hand, we learn from our Mahayana sutras and from Dogen, who says this all the time, We are already Buddhas. We are already realizing the unrealizable every moment, whether we know it or not, because that's the characteristic of being a human in time. And life is always that way. One hand, right? The other hand, all the time. And if we get fixated on one hand and forget about the other hand, we can get into trouble. And it's sometimes hard to keep both hands in motion, but this is both hands, right? That's both hands. So that's Dogen's way of understanding the Buddha. So let's read some verses from this chapter. I'm starting at the beginning and I'm using the Gil Fronsdale translation. The Buddha's victory cannot be undone. No one in the world can approach it. By what path would you guide him who has no path, whose field is endless? The Buddha has no ensnaring, embroiling craving to lead him. By what path would you guide him who has no path, whose field is endless? Even the gods envy the awakened ones, the mindful ones, the wise ones, who are intent on meditation and delight in the peace of renunciation. So, although the Eightfold Path of the Buddha is well known, the 10 stages of bodhisattvas are well known, the 6 paramitas are well known, the 7 factors of enlightenment, and so on and so on. Here we learn that the Buddha actually has no path. The Buddha's path is a pathless path, and it is endless. Just like a bird flying around in the sky, soaring this way and that way, there's no path, there's no road, there's no track. There's just the freedom, the soaring in air. And really and truly, nothing could be better and more exhilarating than this. And nothing can ever take it away. And the opposite of it is craving, obsession, being caught, being ensnared, grounded, imprisoned, grasping after something that is not there. So the next verse gives us the characteristics of the Buddha. This is 180. Sorry, no. 181, the verse that I just read, gives the characteristics of the Buddha. It says, the Buddha is the one who is awake, who is mindful, who is wise, who is intent on meditation and delighting in renunciation. So, awake, meaning alive to this life, not removed from this life by fear or grasping. Mindful means simply present, no matter the situation or state of mind. Now, mindfulness, I guess, is still really, really popular and spoken about a lot. There was a time there where it was hard to avoid seeing stuff about mindfulness. It's maybe that time is over, but still there's a lot of stuff about mindfulness. And I think that sometimes people mistake mindfulness for like knowing something. I am mindful of this. I now know this. I noticed that. Mindfulness means I see what's going on. I'm on top of things. I'm in control. I'm aware. I'm successful in my life. Mindfulness is good for you. That even Kaiser will tell you that, it's good for your health. Mindfulness is all of that. But actually, in Buddhist mindfulness, there's no I in mindfulness, although in the word mindfulness there is an I, but in Buddhist mindfulness there is no I in it. That's the whole point of it. There's no I in it. The mindfulness of the Buddha has nothing to do with being on top of things, with knowing things, with being in control of things, with increasing competence. Buddha's mindfulness is simply presence with what is and the totality of it, without needing anything from it. Meditation, to be able to calm the mind, return to the mind, be grounded in the present moment. Renunciation, letting go of everything, even letting go of letting go. To be willing to just be there, plainly and ordinarily be there, no matter what the weather. And in this sense, to be willing to be a refuge for a troubled world. And the world is always troubled and always has been troubled. So all those qualities describe the Buddha. Verse 182. It is difficult to be born a human. Difficult is the life of mortals. It is difficult to hear the true Dharma. Difficult is the arising of Buddhas. Though in both cases, there's two couplets here. In both cases, they use the phrase is used, it is difficult. Actually, the phrase means something different in both cases. It is difficult to be human means that it's hard to be human. It's tragic, inherently tragic, being human, because there's a lot of inevitable suffering involved. Even for someone who is very, very fortunate, there is no escape from suffering in the human realm. So it's difficult to be human. It's difficult to hear the Dharma, and for a Buddha to arise means in this case that it's rare for these things to happen. Actually, both are rare, because in the vast cosmos, you know, beyond our galaxy, there are very few human beings. Forget the galaxy, even just here on Earth, the amount of beings that exist, including microscopic beings and beings in the sea and beings in the air and beings on the land, the number of them that are human beings is actually very, very few. So although you can go and when you're in traffic, you think, gee, there's a lot of human beings, but they're all concentrated in a small place, a small area. You know, there are not that many human beings, really. So it is rare and precious and something to be grateful for, that one has been born to be one of those very rare human beings. And then among those human beings, it is very rare to encounter a Buddha and the teachings. So we, all of us here together, are very, very fortunate beings, right? Number one, we got to be human. And number two, we got to hear the Dharma and value it and practice it. This is a real blessing for all of us, and we want to not forget that. It's easy to forget it, but we shouldn't forget it. Doing no evil, verse 183. Doing no evil, engaged in what is skillful, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Those three items might sound familiar to you, because they are the three pure precepts. In the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, the first three are the triple refuge, the second three are the pure precepts, and then the 10 clear mind precepts. So these are the three pure precepts: not to do what causes suffering, to do what causes joy and well-being for self and others, and to purify the mind. And interestingly, in Mahayana Buddhism, purify the mind is understood to actually mean to live for the benefit of others, or as we chant, to save all beings. So to save all beings and to purify the mind are two ways of understanding the same exact phenomenon. If you think you're going to save beings without purifying your mind, you don't understand saving beings at all. If you think you can purify your mind without saving all beings, then you don't understand your mind at all. Verse 184. Patient endurance is the supreme austerity. The Buddhas say that nirvana is supreme. One who injures others is no renunciant. One who harms another is no contemplative. So patient endurance, kshanti paramita, is one of the six paramitas of bodhisattva practice. And it's really, really important because among other powers that kshanti paramita bestows, it gives you the power to endure all kinds of hardships and abuses from others without becoming wrecked or wounded. You can absorb the blows without needing to lash out or seek vengeance. So you don't have a need to harm other people. Non-harming is the mark of renunciation. Non-harming is the mark of nirvana. So the practice of kshanti paramita is paramount for renunciates. And that's what renunciation really means, letting everything come and letting everything go. 185, not disparaging others, not causing injury, practicing restraint by the monastic rules, knowing moderation in food, dwelling in solitude, and pursuing the higher states of mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So moderation, restraint, solitude, when you first hear that, it might not sound like that much fun. But it only seems like that from the point of view of attachment and obsession. The Buddha sees these things, moderation, restraint, solitude, as the most wonderful and pleasurable things, the things that bring the most contentment, more joy than anything that is possible in ordinary life. Here, the higher states of mind refers to the supreme joys of the religious life, the pleasures of meditation and deep perception and insight that come with a life of spiritual cultivation. I'm so conditioned by my long years of Zen practice that it doesn't sound right to me to talk about higher states, you know, as if we're going to get something higher than we had before. Because I don't think that there are any states that are higher than any other states. But the pleasures of practice are wonderful, not mysterious really, not even actually so unusual. But they are deeply wonderful, as so many of you already know, and deeply fulfilling. Just to be alive in this truly amazing, bright world is enough, you know. What else does anybody need? I mean, I'm lucky because I, in the morning, you know, now we sit, it's light outside, you know, in the morning, and but it's early, so I can see every day the most amazing clouds, you know. I walk out of our little zendo, I see clouds. That's enough. I did enough for the day. I had enough for the day. I don't need anything else. These clouds, the colors of them and the shapes of them, it's amazing. Going on. Not even with a shower of gold coins would we find satisfaction in sensual craving, knowing that sensual cravings are suffering, that they bring little delight. The sage does not rejoice even in divine pleasures. One who delights in the ending of craving is a disciple of the fully awakened one. When you come to think of it, if you were showered with gold coins, it might be an unpleasant experience, because they would hurt, they would that wouldn't be fun, so and having a pile of money would be not so much fun, and just seeing the money on your screen and worrying about the numbers, I don't think gives you that much pleasure. Just as if someone were to put in front of you a giant mountain, you picture it, of really tasty food piled one atop the other. This would be like a disgusting thing, not a happy thing. And if you just were forced to look at endless scenes of beauty, one after another, hour after hour after hour, pretty soon you'd get tired of it. And if you had like weeks and weeks and weeks of constant sexual activity, you would never want to hear the word sex ever again. So sensual craving, we all think, oh, sensuality is good. But that's because we don't get it as much as we think we want it. But here it says, actually it's suffering. And it's the craving part that's the suffering. Because the craving part is what distorts sensuality. Simple appreciation or enjoyment of the senses is wonderful. After all, you seeing the sunset with your eyes, that's a sensual pleasure, right? So it's pleasant and it's very easy when there isn't any craving or obsession. In fact, every experience that is associated with being a human being, which includes thinking and meditation, all experiences are, according to Buddhist analysis, sensual experiences. They all involve the six senses. To be alive is to be immersed in the six senses. So the difference is not the presence or absence of sensuality, because it's never absent, but whether one accepts and appreciates sensuality as it really is, or instead is constantly craving for something that can never be found, even when the senses are fully engaged and the joy is actually available, but we don't experience it because we're looking for something more. And this is a particularly salient teaching in Zen. This is something Zen really emphasizes. Just open your eyes and look. Just open your mouth and taste. Open your ears and hear. Open your mind and think. The whole of eternal, unrepeatable reality is entirely there. What are we running around looking for? Going on. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, to forests, parks, trees, and shrines. But none of these is a secure refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, then the Eightfold Path leading to the end of suffering, then this is the secure refuge. This is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So this chapter is called the Buddha. So it, in the, as in these verses, it contains the basic foundational teachings that define the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and this is the only true refuge, the only secure refuge, by contrast to the previous stanza. And this is really true. There is no refuge. There is no escape. It used to be that people thought that they could escape. They could leave the family, the homeland. They could go to a faraway country where nobody knows you and you could start all over again. You could go to the desert, go to the mountains, go to faraway America, where anything is possible. Or if you're already in America, then you can go west, where there's not many people. That's the way it used to be. But now, there's no place you can go that you can't be found. There's cell service everywhere. You can be tracked down wherever you are. You can't escape anywhere. And even if somehow you figured out how not to be tracked down, and you really found a way, you'd have to work at it to lose yourself in the world. You would still be there. All your conditioning, all your past, all your pain and limitation would be there with you, even if no one else could find you. You would have changed only the scenery. So it's true, the only escape, the only refuge, the only security is to fundamentally change, to throw away your conditioned mind and become truly free by understanding the depth of your suffering, the cause of your suffering, the possibility of its end, and fully embracing the path to end it. Then you could find a secure refuge. And the beauty of it is that that refuge is not far away. You don't have to buy a big airline ticket to get there. It's always right exactly where you are. And it's always there now. And it is never too late to find that refuge. That's the beauty of it going on. It's hard to find a noble person. Such a person is not born everywhere. When such a wise one is born, the family flourishes in happiness. Happy is the arising of Buddhas. Happy is the teaching of the true Dharma. Happy is the harmony of the Sangha. Happy is the ardent practice of those in harmony. So when a wise person appears, it's a great benefit to everyone. In a family, in a village, in a nation, wise people are truly a blessing. Money, power, and prestige are much praised in the world. But the truth is that in the long run, and even now at any moment in the deep undercurrent of our human journey together, there is nothing stronger or more effective or more important than true human wisdom. The wisdom of the heart is still, even though it doesn't look like it, the most important thing in the world. Verse 94, like the verses beforehand, refer to Buddha Dharma Sangha. And this tells you that wherever you have the Buddha, you always have Dharma and Sangha. So the Buddha without Dharma and Sangha is a sort of impossible idea. It's like a chicken with lips, There couldn't be a Buddha without the Dharma and the Sangha. These three are really one. And the characteristic of these three, which are one, is deep happiness. The word that Gill translates as ardent is tapas. Some people, I checked a bunch of translations, some people translate it as austerity, which seems a little quite different. Some translate it as spiritual endeavor or practice, which might require a degree of discipline or restraint. But ardent is really good because the root of the word tapas seems to be something like warmth, generating warmth. And this seems true of our practice. It generates warmth, it warms us up. It is heartwarming, like they say. in the last verses of the chapter, the merit of worshiping those worthy of worship, be they Buddhas or disciples, who have transcended their obsessive thinking, passed beyond sorrow and grief, gone to peace, and who have nothing to fear, can never be calculated by any estimation. So this final verse has to do with the virtue that is accrued by praising or making offerings to the Buddha. And in traditional Buddhist societies, there was a real conviction that if you did that, if you praised the Buddha and made offerings to the Buddha, you got a tremendous benefit from this. And this was taken quite seriously and quite literally in Asia in the past. And I believe in many Asian cultures, even in the present, people still believe this. And so in the past, very wealthy kings and princes and merchants, and in the present, billionaires in Asia, not infrequently give great quantities of funding to Buddhist establishments and teachers because they believe that doing so is going to bring them positive karma in this and future lifetimes. In the West, and the rest of the rational, scientific, modern world, which is pretty much everywhere, where you do not believe anything unless the data supports it, still, people do give to religion, but far less than they used to in centuries gone by. Sometimes I complain about this. I often note that it is not that hard to fund a medical center or a piece of medical or weapons research or a luxury hotel. Fairly easy to get funding for these things. Tech startup, you can get a lot of money for that easily. And the reason why is because these things will make money. But try to establish a Zen center and receive the many dollars that it takes to build one, and you won't even start to begin with. All the Zen centers we have began maybe 50 years ago when it was easier to do. Now it's really, really hard to do. And most Zen teachers can't earn a living. It's not a good career path. Don't become a Zen teacher as a career path, because I'm sorry for you, you know, you'll never be able to support yourself. And it's really, to me, it's like a stunning thing, because I really know how valuable these teachings are and this practice is, and yet, you know, it's completely a throwaway in our commercial world. So it's too bad. I wish that Zen teachers had a way to support themselves through their practice. On the other hand, in the world we live in now, wealth is corruptible. It's hard for wealth not to be corrupted in subtle ways, and not so subtle ways sometimes. So maybe it is not a bad thing that Zen practice and other kinds of Buddhist practice are so completely unimportant and so hard up for funds. I think it might not be a bad thing. It might be very good for us. Thankfully, however, because our needs are modest and your generosity is extraordinary, this is not true of everyday Zen. Everyday Zen is not hard up for money. We are okay financially because we have super low overhead. So don't stop supporting us. Now that I said that, please do. We still need the donations to keep going. But, you know, we're okay. We're okay. We're fortunate. We're really fortunate. I never thought when I retired from the Zen Center, I was scared to death that I would never be able to keep practicing full time and still survive economically in this crazy California expensive place. But thanks to you, I can do it. So I'm one of the lucky ones and one of the rare ones. Okay, chapter 14. Now we're at chapter 15, happiness, which is, we've read many times in the Dhammapada how much happiness is central to the Buddhist path, a path of happiness, a path of healing. Maybe I've told you before that someplace reading an old sutra, I always like the things, you know, like in the sutras that you don't notice. And once I saw this in a sutra where there's a king who's looking around to the different groups, you know, the different spiritual groups to see which one is the best. And he concluded that the Buddha's community was the best because when he would hang around there, it looked to him like the Sangha members were happy and content and it made him feel good. So he decided to cast his lot with the Buddhists. There is, on the other hand, as many of us know, a very common attitude in spiritual practice of seriousness and grimness, right? You've seen that. The truth is serious and very hard to find. And it requires great sacrifice and austerity. So a serious practitioner is never smiling or lighthearted. This is true in Zen, where you know you meditate with great strength and determination as much as possible, with a great grimace on your face. And for some reason, I don't know why, this has always struck me as such a strange thing, because all my life I always thought that religious practice is the most interesting thing, you know, the most fun and fulfilling thing. So the idea that it's something grim always struck me as bizarre. I really do think that the spiritual path is fundamentally a path of ease and joy and happiness. It's much easier. People think, oh, you know, you have to meditate every day and this and that. No, that's way easier. Way, way easier than the ordinary worldly life, which is so stressful and so impossibly difficult. I don't know how anyone manages it, but I admire those who do. Fortunately, I never had to really do that. But people who do it, wow, you know, they are great because it's so hard. Okay, so that's my little introduction to the chapter, and now I read the chapter. Ah, so happy we live. Without hate, among those who hate, among people who hate, we live without hate. Ah, so happily we live, without misery, among those in misery. Among people in misery, we live without misery. Ah, so happily we live, without ambition, among those with ambition. Among people who are ambitious, we live without ambition. So we're learning from these verses that our happiness in practice doesn't depend on our drawing a circle around ourselves and living within a nice Buddhist practice bubble and never going out of it so that we don't have to ever encounter misery or hatred. No, it says we are living happily right in the middle of misery and hatred. And this doesn't mean that we're ignoring the misery or the hatred or that we don't feel it and understand it. It means that we're not overcome by it. We're not pushed around by the misery and the hatred we see and feel all around. We know how to take it in. We understand it. And we know how to feel compassion for those who are in the midst of it, even as we ourselves remain quite happy. Sometimes people feel guilty about this. They feel guilty if they're happy when other people are suffering. They think they should suffer too. And I can understand this, you know, it kind of makes sense. And in a way, you know, you could see it as a very beautiful thing. And when you think about it, that is a very strong theme in Christianity, as far as I understand Christianity, which is not so much, but it seems like that is a theme in Christianity, because after all, God suffers the worst of sufferings on behalf of all of us sinners. So, in imitation of God, we also suffer on behalf of others who suffer. So it's very noble. I can understand it and appreciate it. But in the Buddhist path, we don't do that. We are happy, even though we see and appreciate deeply the suffering all around us. And it's not a contradiction, and it is not unfeeling to be happy when others are not happy. In fact, I think we should be happy, because what are we going to share with other people if we have misery? If we have happiness, we can share our happiness with those who don't have much happiness, and we can bring them some comfort. What good does it do to your friend in need who is maybe miserable if you yourself are miserable? How are you going to help them? How does that help them, being miserable too? On the other hand, there's always the other hand, as we said before. And my teacher always said that. He didn't say the other hand, though. He always said the other side. He would say something, blah, 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 and then he would say, and the other side is, and then he would say the opposite. On the other hand, there is the famous story of Layman Pong and his daughter Lin Zhao. The layman falls down in the snow. I think maybe it's in the snow. And he falls down at the big snowdrift, and he says, "Help, help, help." And Lin Zhao rushes over and hurls herself down in the snow next to him. How is this helping? But this is not Lin Zhao being brought low by her father's suffering. This is Lin Zhao sharing the suffering without losing her happiness. Because this is also true. We are all in the same boat. We all share the same suffering. And that's what makes us happy, sharing life together in solidarity with everyone. That's what really, really makes you happy. The word that Gill translates in verse 99, 199 as ambition is usaka. Happiness is to be free of ambition. And the word does seem to mean something like striving, pushing forward, maybe sort of restlessly going on. But it's a little provocative, I think, maybe to use the word ambition, because I think we do think of ambition as something positive, right? It's no good to lack ambition. That's to be lazy, it's not so good. We should be doing stuff which takes ambition. I mean, we might say to be too ambitious, especially ambitious for the wrong things, is not good, but we should be ambitious. It's on the whole a good thing, because ambition is energy. It's the opposite of laziness. And in Mahayana Buddhism, there's this important practice of Viryaparamita that goes along with Shantiparamita, one of the six paramitas, joyful energy, specifically joyful energy for the good. However, we have to admit that the Dhammapada really does want to say non-ambition. Not ambition. Letting go. Not striving. Simply being present with what is rather than trying to do something with it. Stepping back into reality fundamentally, receptively, so as to let reality be as it is, rather than stepping forward, messing around with reality, even with the intention of trying to improve things. So we have to give the Dhammapada credit for this rather radical idea. To fundamentally, radically let things alone, let them be as they are. So I think it's good for us, challenging for us to contemplate this teaching and try to find it in our hearts to fully take it in and appreciate it, experiment with it, understand it, see its virtues. Doing nothing, saying nothing, letting everything be. I think that might be more difficult for a lot of us than doing something. Doing nothing might be the hardest thing to do. Anyway, I recommend that you think about this and check it out in your living, see what it's like. Verse 200. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments, we shall feast on joy as do the radiant gods. So the thing about letting things alone without any attachments is that it brings us joy. And you could say, well, you know, fine, forget about everything, let the world go, be happy. It's like the old Mayor Baba saying that Bobby McFerrin made so famous, you know, don't worry, be happy. Which maybe is a good idea, but I think here there's more to it than that. Here it's really implying that to push things, to want things, is to fundamentally misunderstand the nature of reality at your peril. Because there is nothing to push, and there is nothing to want. And all efforts to push and want lead to pain for self and others. It's not that we could do something good, but we decide not to because it's too much trouble and would ruin our happiness. It's not that. It's that we know that not pushing reality is in fact the only way to live in this world as it really is. And the next two verses kind of explain why. Victory gives birth to hate. The defeated sleep in anguish. Giving up both victory and defeat, those who have attained peace sleep happily. There is no fire like lust, no misfortune like hate, no suffering like the aggregates, and no happiness higher than peace. So, victory and defeat depend on one another. They always go together. There's no victory without defeat. There's no defeat without victory. And when there's defeat, there's hatred and resentment. And when you think about the great tragedy of human history, especially in this last 100 years or so that have been so dramatic and destructive, and even before that, and even now, when our world is so dramatic in its suffering, you can see how this is so. Because victory for one means defeat for another, and defeat breeds resentment and anger and bitterness, which leads to more activity and more, based on that bitterness and anger, and that leads to more conflict. And then there's a challenge for another victory and another defeat. And where does that end? How far and how long does all that go on? In the middle of the battle, the only thing you're striving for is to win. Even if it costs you your life, you will win. And maybe you do win. But that means somebody else loses. And they get mad. And they eventually, maybe it takes a while, get ready for revenge. And then comes the next war, and the passion, and the hatred. Which, the final line of the verse tells us, all of that is built into the five grasping skandhas, the five aggregates that are the essential nature of our human mind and heart, forms, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. It's all right there. So it's not a question of giving up doing things, which might be a good outcome, but they might be difficult to do. It's a question of understanding how the world is, how the mind and the heart really are, and no longer being caught up in the cycle of suffering that has gone on from the beginning of time. Now, I've been going on and on here about doing nothing, but of course, doing nothing doesn't mean doing nothing. The only way to really do nothing is to be dead, because as long as you're alive, you're always doing something. That's what life is. Life is doing stuff. As long as we're alive, we're going to do this and that. So it's not a question of doing or not doing. It's a question of what we do and how we do it. Whether we let go of our need to do and be more and more, and instead of that, simply do what we know is right and good and compassionate without thinking that we can control or even understand the full scope of what happens in this world. Hunger is the foremost illness, sankhara is the foremost suffering. For one who knows this as it really is, nirvana is the foremost happiness. Health is the foremost possession, contentment the foremost wealth, trust the foremost kinship, and nirvana the foremost happiness. Tasting the flavor of solitude and peace, one becomes free of distress and evil, drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. So the first of these verses names what erodes and diminishes our lives. Hunger, in all senses of that word. And samskaras, which is usually translated as formations. It's one of the five skandhas. Formations, fabrications, volitions, the grabbiness, the doing, needing doing. In other words, our putting a conditioned world together in our minds and then immediately being alienated and pushed around by this world we created, so that we feel like we either have to flee or defend. Hunger attacks the body, samskaras attack the mind and heart and soul. And the next verse is the contrary, what most supports our life. Health supports our body, and contentment, trust, and nirvana support the mind, heart, and soul. And this is the first time that I can remember, anyway, that the word trust is used in these chapters. And trust is a word that I use a lot. It's really important. And trust has lots of resonance in the moment we're living in now, because one of the things that's really been eroded a lot is trust. It seems really hard to trust anyone, any information, any institution, any theory. It's hard to trust right now. You can't even trust Siri, you know? Thank you, Siri. Are you all right? She must be fine. So it's hard to trust, right? It's hard to find that which can be trusted. Here, trust is mentioned. It's something really, really important for us. But here, it's not trust in this or that. It's fundamentally trust in ourselves and trust in what we know in our hearts to be true and reliable. We say trust in Buddha Dharma Sangha, we read already. That's the truest refuge. But what we mean when we say that is trust in human goodness and in the human capacity to bring that goodness into our lives and into the world. Trust that. Trust in your own understanding of your own spiritual practice and in your friends. So I think it's the most important thing. Trust in the world. Trust in life. Trust in yourself. If you don't have that trust, it's really very hard to live with any degree of happiness. Trust that can never be shattered. Trust that develops nirvana, peace, and contentment. Next verses, coming to the end. Tasting the flavor of solitude and peace, one becomes free of distress and evil, drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. It's good to see the noble ones, their company is always a delight. Free from the sight of fools, one would constantly be happy. One who keeps company, therefore, sorry, wait. One who keeps company with fools will grieve for a long, long time. Living with fools is painful, as is living with foes. Living with the wise is delightful, like relatives gathered together. Therefore, you should follow a good, intelligent person who is wise, insightful, learned, committed to virtue, dutiful, and noble, as the moon follows the path of the stars. And I think that noble person they're referring to there is the Buddha. So the first of those verses mentions like relatives gathered together. And I think that that's true. You know, a Buddhist Sangha or any community gathered together around spiritual practice is always like a family. It has a feeling like a family, which I hope is a good thing. Sometimes families can be not so good. And in spiritual communities, of course, inevitably people bring their families into the community, the conditioning, right, that's built into them from their families. They bring it into the community. And then various kinds of conflicts will arise in the community, as commonly happens. But, and that can be, you know, sometimes for people that's very painful if they can't shake the conditioning. It can be very painful and they end up leaving the community. And I always feel really, really sad about that because, you know, it's kind of like you invest yourself in a practice community and in a practice and then you feel like it betrays you. That's really, really sad to me. But those conflicts are not so bad when people take the practice to heart. And even when those difficult things arise, they figure out how to practice with them. And then they learn from the experience, and they really grow. And that helps them eventually to go beyond their conditioning. So in that sense, those conflicts don't have to be a tragedy or don't have to be avoided. They just have to be practiced with instead of, you know, reinforced as is. But also, families are very, very sweet, right? It's not like family is an evil thing. No, families are great because families are founded on a tremendous love. That's what makes a family a family. And so we hope that we have that kind of love in our sanghas. And we hope that a sangha can be a family, maximizing the love and minimizing the attachment and the confusion that are always there whenever there are human beings around. We hope that the Sangha family, inspired by the Dharma, can be truly loving and supportive. And I hope our community is as much that way as we can possibly make it. So the last stanza I said is a little bit of another commercial for the Buddha. The Sangha does need the Buddha at the center of it. It's not just a community of friends doing a kind of practice together, Because it has to have at the center of it, Buddha. It has to have awakening at the center of it. That's what really makes it a true Sangha. The Buddha, who is wise, intelligent, virtuous, who illuminates the Sangha, as the verse says, like the moon illuminates the sky. And I suppose in the past, in the time of Shakyamuni Buddha and beyond, there were great people like that, great teachers that we read about in our books. And even in our time, we have been fortunate to have had great, great teachers among us who have transmitted the Dharma to us from Asia. Many of them, if not most of them, if not all of them, now gone. In my opinion, though, in the era that we're living in, we should understand this verse not to describe a person that we're looking for, a great leader, an enlightened individual, but we should understand this verse to refer to the qualities that all of us possess within ourselves, aspire to develop, and hope and trust that we will find in one another. So yeah, oh hi. It's Paula's little boy, girl, hard to tell. Hi, thank you for being there, cheering us all up. We're all so serious over here. So yes, we do hope, let's hope and pray that we can have in our sanghas good leaders, wise leaders, trusted leaders who can guide sanghas. It's easier and better when we have that. But even if we did have that, we would not anymore, and it wouldn't be right anymore, to invest the kind of power and adulation in them as the way we did in the past, as if they were great sages who we understand to be different from us, other people, great people, different from us, apart, individuals apart, superior to others. We know now that that's not right, because we understand that there is no such thing, right, as a separate person, complete and separate on their own. Everybody is only a Buddha and a Buddha. This is one of Dogen's biggest points, right? Only a Buddha and a Buddha. That's what a Buddha is, a Buddha and a Buddha. And the wisdom and the intelligence and the virtue arises between us. That's where it comes from. And that's why in this era we understand that, and we would never make the mistake of thinking that somebody else outside of us, you know, has something that we don't have. That would be complete misunderstanding of what our sages have taught us. So it's only a Buddha and a Buddha. That's not an individual. It's the magic of our Dharma connections. Oh my gosh, look how long that took to say all that. I didn't know it would take that long. So before we stop, I would want to tell you a few things just in case some of you might have to go off. I'm going to Mexico again to do a practice event with conflict resolution people who are trying to bring peace to conflict, and I'm going to help to train them to use meditation to be better at that. I've been doing this for a long time with my friend Gary Friedman. So I'll be gone a week, and Kathy will be taking care of the seminar next week. But here's some homework, and if she forgets to ask about the homework, you can remind her. The homework would be study happiness. Study happiness in your own life. First of all, what is happiness? Is there any such thing as I am a happy person? I mean, like I'm happy all the time? Is happiness something that could be all the time? Or is that not a reasonable idea? If you're happy sometimes, why? What are the conditions for the happiness? And if you're not happy sometimes, what are the conditions for that? Why are you not able to be happy in certain moments of your life? So study happiness. I think it'd be very interesting to see what you discover. And yeah, I'm really sorry that I went on so long, because there isn't really enough time to do everything that we usually do. So I'm going to stop, and instead of taking the time to put everybody in groups, regretfully, I don't think we have time to do that. So let's see if anybody has any comments, just a few comments, and then we'll chant and maybe end on time or a little earlier, if there isn't much to say. And again, I'm so enthusiastic about the Dhammapada, you know, I get into it, and so I apologize. So Shufi, we